Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is WebSphere MQ, Finding Your Way Around Channels. Today's presenters are Beverly Kingsley, Kenneth Langhorn, Rick Armstrong, and Mark Romack. Beverly is an experienced support software engineer with several years of experience with IBM, working with WebSphere MQ, Qix, and IMS. Prior to that, she spent 5 years at ExxonMobil as an IMS systems programmer. Kenneth has worked with IBM customer support and services for more than 20 years. Currently, he is a member of the WebSphere MQ support team. Rick has worked with IBM customer support and services since 1989. He is currently a member of the COS WebSphere MQ support team. Mark joined the WebSphere MQ team in 2004, working previously on comm server products. Mark is a co-author of the IBM Red Book, Solution-Based Security on COS. At this point in time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Beverly, Kenneth, Rick, and Mark.
Hey, good morning, everyone. This is Rick Armstrong. Joseph, if everyone would turn to page 2 for the agenda, I'd like to thank you for joining us today. We hope to make this time useful for you. Hopefully you become more productive in your MQ world and where you work. There's a lot of expertise on the phone here working with ZOS, WebSphere MQ. The presenters I'll talk about on the next slide, but today we're going to talk about channels, of course. And I know there's a lot of information about channels, but we're going to talk about 4 different aspects. One thing is about channel pairs, when to use sender-receiver, when are clustered receiver-sender channels used, all those kinds of things. Next, we'll talk about some of the parameters, what's the difference between keep-alive interval and TCP keep-alive, and a bunch of different parameters. And then we'll talk about what's found in the channel initiator log. There's a lot of information there, and we'll talk about that. And then we'll talk about a little bit about the underlying transport, about how data flows from channel to channel. If you'll flip over to page 3, the presenters, Mark is going to talk about the channels, the channel pairs, and general discussion of the channels. Kenneth Langhorn will follow him up with some of the parameters that are important for channels and what they mean and when to use them. Beverly Kingsley will follow that up with the channel initiator job log and the JES log. What can we find there and what's useful? How do we sort through all the information there and find something useful? And then I will talk about channels and the underlying network. I'm going to turn it over to Mark right now. If you go to page 4.
Okay, thanks a lot, Rick, and good morning, everybody. So I'll generally cover channels. While MQ supports many different channel types, those types have to be compatible in order for the channel types to function together. Now, typically, point-to-point configurations will define a sender on a local MQ host and a like-named receiver on the remote host. In this configuration, an XMIC queue is defined on the sender side, which will have the same name as the target queue manager. If there is no local definition of a remote queue with the transmit queue attribute, then the transmit queue named for the target queue manager will be used. If this transmit queue does not exist, then the transmission queue named in the queue manager's default transmit queue attribute will be used as a last resort. So MQ has 3 methods of finding out which transmit queue to use to speak to the remote platform. And this is on slide 4, by the way. For the requester-server pair, the requester is the only channel type that does not require a transmit queue to be defined before the channel was allowed to start. Requester channels fall under the umbrella of caller MCAs, just like sender channels or cluster senders and fully qualified server channels, because all these type channels can initiate communication on a channel. On the other end, responder MCAs do just that, responding to the side that initiated the channel communication, such as a receiver channel would. Now, when a requester channel starts a channel to the remote server, it does so to receive messages from the server side. The server honors this request by sending messages from the transmit queue defined on its channel definition, just as would happen with a requester-sender pair. If configured properly as a fully qualified server channel would be, the server can also initiate this communication with the end goal of sending messages to the requester. A server that is not fully qualified always has to be started by the requester side. A fully qualified server is one which contains the connection name information for the requester side. MQ also allows for requesters and senders to be paired together. This makes callback possible where a requester initiates a connection to the sender. The sender terminates that initial call and then uses its own channel definition to call back the requester, after which it sends messages from its transmission queue to the requester. In our next case, while a server channel can be paired with a receiver channel, there is not much functional difference between this configuration and one where a sender channel is paired with a receiver. Only a fully qualified server can initiate a connection in this case, much like a sender would, and similarly messages flow from server to receiver, just as in the topology where a sender-receiver pair is configured. And then now we'll move to the next slide on your PDFs. On this slide, we look at client cons and server cons, which are referred to as MQI channels, and these are the only MQI channels. Such channels are not between queue managers, but instead between clients and MQ servers. MQI channels are bidirectional, since messages can flow either to or from the client. Typically, on MQI channels, a sequence of requests from the client and responses from the MQ server allow data in many forms, including XML, SOAP, and JMS traffic, to flow. You can contrast this to all of the other channels, which are referred to as message channels. Message channels are only defined between queue managers, and messages only flow from the side that hosts the transmit queue for that connection. All MQ platforms, except for Z-Series MQ, automatically will create a server con definition on the MQ server if a client initiates a connection request to the server. The last compatible channel pair is between the cluster sender and the cluster receiver. One key takeaway for this channel type is that no matter how the cluster sender is defined, once a cluster sender cluster receiver pair starts, no matter how the cluster sender was originally defined, the cluster sender takes on all of the defined characteristics of the remote cluster receiver from then on out. Now we'll go to the next slide. Clients can connect to instances of MQ in a few ways, where the client's needs should determine how connectivity is established. For clients that need high message availability provided by a queue sharing group, such users are better off to connect to a generic interface on ZOS than to connect directly to a specific queue manager. This represents greater front-end availability, since connection is made possible to any queue manager in the group. On the other hand, connecting directly to a specific queue manager in the group gives the ability to put messages to a shared target queue, increasing your back-end availability. Now let's move to the next slide, number 7, I believe. And the title here was, What's So Funny About Cluster Channels? Well, actually, nothing's funny about cluster channels. They provide great workload balancing, system administration is handled automatically by MQ, and the design of clustering inherently provides increased object availability. As an example, a simple MQ network with 4 queue managers and 2 local queues would require the administrator to define 68 objects. In a clustered environment, that same topology is reduced to just 16 objects. This reduces the chance of definitional errors as well. Clustering polices itself, it cleans up after itself, and it even does whatever it's told to do, which is also one reason why you may run into issues with it. With all of this robustness, the user has to be clear about the way clustering works because simple commands can bring on a change in behavior that's unexpected, but working as designed. Take refresh cluster repos yes, for instance. A cluster has been functioning perfectly well for 10 years. One day, an operator decides to issue this command with the repos flavor. This is fine if the full repositories have always been hosted on the same machine. That is, they've never moved, they've never changed IP address. But if they've ever moved, even, say, 5 years, 6 years before, issuing this flavor of refresh cluster will cause the partial repositories in the cluster to look for their full repositories at the old IP address, not the new one. This means channels will go into retry. And this is the documented design. So how do you fix it? Well, for that particular case, the IP address picked up was retrieved from the originally manually defined cluster sender when the cluster was put into place. So you'd have to correct the cluster sender definition to point it to the new IP address. And as always, we recommend that you read all usage notes on any commands for clustering, especially for refresh cluster, since it may not be the right answer for all your cluster issues. Now, the next bullet just reiterates that after a cluster sender starts to a cluster receiver, its contents become an amalgamation of what was originally defined as what the cluster receiver contains. As you define cluster senders to full repositories, know that there needn't be any more than two full repositories in a cluster. Why just two? Is it more better? Well, number one, there's several reasons why you need just two. Number one, the second full repository exists just in case the first full repository fails over. Availability is improved that way. Number two, even if no full repositories are available to the cluster for a while, application traffic continues to flow unaffected, and only object changes are not propagated. Number three, increasing the numbers of full repositories causes an increased flow of internal cluster traffic. And the fourth reason is because partial repositories only subscribe or publish changes to two full repositories at the most, so the extra repositories wouldn't get much use. And also keep in mind, only two full repositories means less required interconnection, since it's documented that all full repositories in a cluster need to be manually interconnected. We'll talk a little bit about message reallocation. There can be times when a cluster channel will no longer seem to be functioning, or it will appear hung, unresponsive to stop commands. This is rare, but it can happen if a network failure forces MQ to begin message reallocation, where MQ attempts to find an alternate path to the destination queue manager. In any event, reallocation can take a long time, and we're talking hours. It can be circumvented, but it's typically recommended that the user allow the reallocation to complete, since MQ will eventually get the messages to the proper cluster object instance if there is a path available at all. And lastly, on clusters, if you engage in a DR event, be sure to not use like channel object names. This can often result in topologies where queue managers that are sending messages see duplicate objects and are unable to route messages to the instance that you expected to route messages to. Names should be unique, and if they're accidentally duplicated, a refresh cluster will need to be done. Let's move on to the next slide. I think it's slide 8, and I'm just going to show that this slide just recaps a few of the points related to these types of channels, the ServerCon channel. And then on the following slide, number 9, these are also some recaps of some of the attributes for those channel types. So that's about it for a general recap of channel use. I'm going to turn it over to Ken Slanghorn, and I believe he's at slide 10.
Good day, everyone. I'm not sure if everyone has seen the notification that you should be able to view this in the Lotus. The web conference is now back and up and running, and whether you're using PDF or the web conference, I believe our page number is 10, where parameters for channels. Now, basically, I'm focusing on the standard channels. Sender receiver is what most people use, and we find that the definitions that are most important to us are either under the alter queue manager or under the defined channel in our information center. You may have noticed if you've upgraded to 7.1 that we no longer use PDF books anymore, and everything is really pointing you to the information center. So one thing you should become familiar with is that 7.1 information center. And when you're dealing with channels, you want to definitely understand what we have under the alter queue manager and what we have under the defined channel. Both of them have about 50 pages of parameters, and they can be your friend, or they can make life interesting if you don't pay attention to them. Let me go to the next page. What I want to focus on is the TCP/IP channels, because SNA has in the past been good about letting us know on both sides when there's an issue. If there is a problem with SNA, you will get a sense code passed back to both sides. And it's the same sense code, and normally it tells you clear and concisely what you need to do to address the SNA issue. But when we have issues with TCP/IP, the challenge seems to be who's going to be notified and what does the notification tell us. Now, over the years, we found that because TCP/IP will normally notify one side, both TCP/IP and MQ series have had to come up with additional parameters to help the notification come through. The ones that we tend to fall back on repeatedly are the .MTA, which is on the queue manager definition for MQ series on ZOS, and the TCP/IP keep alive. Those two are our friends, and you definitely should have them coded whenever you're dealing with TCP/IP. Now, the interesting thing is that on the distributed platforms, the TCP/IP keep alive is set for everybody on the box, but on ZOS, we have this KAINT, or keep alive interval, that is channel specific. And on ZOS, you set it for your channel. Now, another pertinent parameter that comes in these days is the receive timeout. That approximates the length of time that the TCP/IP channel will wait to receive data. And so it helps you become notified if it doesn't get a response in a timely manner. Can we go to the next page, 12, I believe. Now, some of my other parameters that come into play are batchlim, which I should clarify, that's really the limit in kilobytes. The definition I have is the batch INT, which is the minimum amount of time in milliseconds for it, so I need to update this slide later on. Another important parameter is the NPM speed, which when you need to have messages go quickly, but you're not concerned if you lose them, you can set that to fast, and your non-persistent messages will go outside of the batch and get to their destination faster. Now, they do have a concern if they can't be delivered with the NPM speed set to fast. They cannot always make it to the dead letter queue. And one of the things we've added at 7.1 is this use DLQ on the channel, which can dictate whether or not you want a channel to stop or stay up if messages can't be delivered. The fourth parameter I have on this page is this reset sequence. Now, that particular parameter is used when you're having problems with channels being out of sync, sequence number mismatch. It's a newer parameter, and it helps you to see what channel is request is outstanding. Next page. Now, as I said, we are using the Information Center at version 7.1, and some of the areas you may find yourself going to if you're having issues with the MQ series are the links I have right here. Just in general, when you have to resolve channel problems, you want to try this link. And all three links can be addressed by the address at the bottom of the page. And these are the sections that they're under. Whenever you have channels having problems, you want to go to the resolving problems with channels. And if that doesn't help you to alleviate the problem, then you probably want to open a problem with us. One thing that you definitely want to talk to IBM on is when you're having in-doubt channels. And that's the second link we have. And the other one I point you to is at the bottom of this page, the channel states. If we go to page 14, it will give you a description of the channel states. Now, whenever we're having problems with channels, it's good to know if the channel is attempting to run, when it stops, it's in that inactive state. Any other time, it should be in one of the four under current. It should either be stopped, starting, retrying, or active if it's actually transmitting or if it's available to send messages across the channel. And I like this particular page because it gives you a big picture of what your channel can be doing when it should be running or when you check it on the current state. Now, can we go to the next page? I think that's page 15. And I like for people to be aware of this because this shows you the states that your channel can get into when you start it up, or just what state it can be in. Whenever you check on a channel, it should be in one of these states. It's good to understand when you're having problems and you have to come and speak to us about it to be able to tell us what's going on with your channel. So these are the base parameters that I think you need for TCP/IP. Now, if you look closely in the info center, you'll see that both the display or author of the queue manager and the Divine channel both have over 50 pages of parameters. So you can spend a lot of time going over them. But if you have specific questions down the road, definitely feel free to check with us on them. Now, at this time, I would like to bring in one of my associates. I believe Beverly is up next.
Oh, thank you, Kenneth. This is Beverly Kinsley. Let's move on to page 16. Okay. Distributed queuing is one of the components of WebSphere MQ. It is handled by the channel initiator, also referred to as the chin or chinit. I use these terms interchangeably. You know, the channel initiator handles and manages the channels. And the mainframe, the chinit runs as a starter task created in its own address space. The distributed queuing messages are issued to the chinit job log or jes log. Almost all the messages begin with CSQX. The X is the component letter that represents the chinit, followed by three integers, plus a character, which is either an E for error or an I for information. So the CSQX messages ending in an E should be given special attention when diagnosing channel errors. Next page, 17. Please. Okay. And this page is a list of important informational messages issued to the chinit job log. The first distributed queuing message is a CSQX00I. It shows the release level of MQ running on Z, followed by the chinit address space starting message CSQX001I in response to the start chinit command. From MQ version 7 and later, message CSQX004I is issued to the channel initiator job log. It's similar to the queue manager message CSQX220I, which displays the amount of virtual storage currently used by the chinit and available in the extended private region. The values are displayed in megabytes, and the message is logged at channel initiator start every hour and more frequently if the memory usage changes up or down by more than 2%. Some customers use this to monitor their chinit storage performance. The CSQX022I is a channel initiator initialization normal completion message. It indicates the chinit is ready for use. So if the chinit is started via the CSQX INPX data set, processing of other commands from that data set might still be in process. So the completion is shown by message CSQ0012I and the master job log. The CSQX034I informational message indicates the queue manager is stopping, so the chinit is also stopping. So starting at version 6, the channel initiator parameters, which used to be specified, and the channel initiator parameter module CSQ6 chip are now queue managers at Tributes. So the CSQ 070i to 82i, or the Chinook parameters and the queue manager attributes. The ones that are alterable are shown via the message CSQ X 90i to 94i. Now, page 18, please. So this has some important error messages that I'd like to highlight. The CSQ X 20N easy, N for some integer, followed by an E, usually reports an error returned from the transport layer and is usually not an enqueue error, but rather errors from the transport layer or the network. The CSQ X, N, and E messages are mostly associated with clustering problems. The CSQ X 5, N, and E messages reports various errors with channels. So most CSQ X 6, NNE type messages or reporting return codes from system SSL. SSL return codes are documented in the system SSL programming manual and reference manual. Usually it's not an enqueue error, especially if you are implementing SSL channels for the first time. Looking for errors on the Chinook job log can sometimes be tedious, so enqueue support has a recexec that extracts all the CSQX message error messages while in ISPF browse, view, or edit mode. An example of a search string is shown here. So if you're interested in this recexec, please request it by email by clicking on my name on page 3 of this presentation. So let's move on to page 19. There is a wraparound line trace for each channel included in the Chinook address space. The trace is kept in 4 kilobyte buffers, which is always active. It cannot be turned off, and it applies to both TCP and LU62 channels. We can use this trace instead of comms trace, depending on the channel problem. So there are two ways to capture it. One is by including the CSQ SNAPDD statement in the Chinook JCL, pointing it to a data set in which to dump the line trace. It gets dumped after you start the Chinook trace, then it should be display channel status save command with the name of the channel in which the line trace is required, as shown here. And the other is to take a dump of the Chinook address space, use the IPCS verbex command shown here to format it. So on the next page, 20, is an example of a line trace using IPCS to format it. The line trace contains the last few inbound and outbound flow for each channel, so it is ideal for problems where a channel appears to be hung because information can be collected about the activities of these channels long after the normal trace has wrapped. It also helps us to identify if the channel problem is within enqueue or not. Notice the timestamp on the left, followed by the word inbound. Right? The TSH high catcher should be on your right, but for some reason, it's missing on this slide. So the layout of the TSH structure is undocumented. However, you can look for unique words in your data in the high catcher section. Unfortunately, this example doesn't show user data in the high catcher section. But in a full line trace, you would see portions of your data which you can use to correlate with the corresponding network trace. So on page 21, the Chinook makes use of first failure support technology, also known as FFST SnapDump. It provides immediate notification and first failure data capture in specific error conditions instead of generating a system dump. The FFS key contains information relating to the error message. Okay, so message CSQX053EASY is also issued at the same time to the channel Chinit Job Lab. So the FFS key snap dump provides customized dump, symptom strings, symptoms records, and from the MQ portal page, you can use this symptom string to search for known problems. To produce a SNAP dump, the CSQ SNAP DD statement must be in the channel initiator start attack procedure. Otherwise, error message CSQX012EASY unable to open CSQ SNAP data set is issued to the Chinit Job Log. Because some problems might be intermittent, it's recommended you include the SNAP DD statement to capture the reason for failure at the time it occurs. So on the next page, 22, on this slide, I want to focus on a pervasive message CSQX526EASY sequence number mismatch. The basic reason is that the sent sequence number doesn't match the expected sequence number. On the next slide, page 23, are some reasons for this error being issued to the Chinit Job Log. Multiple sender channels reference the same instance of a receiver channel. The system channel sync queue contains invalid or duplicate messages or is damaged. Less likely, but possible, is that someone reset the sequence number manually. So if the expected sequence number is 1, then the receiver channel has created a new sync queue message as it did not recognize the partner comms ID and queue manager name. Or the sync queue cleared before migrated versions of MQ was brought up. There are several options for resolving this error. Use the reset channel command to reset regular channels or reset the receiver to match the sender sequence. Note that reset command and the receiver only resets the number on that end, but the reset on a sender resets the number on both ends the next time the channel starts. You should ensure only one unique sending channel references a remote receiver. Note that the reset channel command does not apply to cluster channels. Cluster receiver channels should not complain about sequence number mismatch, but just take whatever is given to them. This is because cluster sender channels can expire, which effectively reset the sequence number to 1. So, or you can simply redefine a new instance of the channel pair. In some instances, the resets may not work, and the CSQ 56EASY could appear again the next time the channel starts. So you can use the cleanup utility CSQ4SUTL to help you locate the bad sync queue record causing the error and to then clean up redundant information from the channel, from the system channel sync queue. This utility can be obtained from the support center and used under the guidance of level 2. So if you're interested in finding the root cause of the CSQ 526EASY sequence mismatch error, then the documentation required is listed on the next slide, page 24. We would require traces of the master and chain. You'll start the master trace, which is also known as global internal MQ trace, by the star traced global RMID class desk res command. The channel initiator, Trace, you can either start that by the Ultra 2 Manager, TRAXSTR, yes, parameter, or you can use the Start Trace Trinit Desk Class RMID command. We also need a slick dump, and the message says to X526EZ, dump in the master and chin address spaces and chin data space using the S-data options shown here. At this point, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Rick Armstrong, who will cover channels and the underlining support layer. Rick?
Thank you, Beverly. We find it difficult to talk about channels without talking about the underlying transport because it's such an important piece of how channels work. And a lot of troubles that you encounter with channels are really caused by the underlying transport. So we're going to spend a few minutes talking about what that means. So we're going to look at this from a TCP/IP perspective as the transport because, go to slide 25, please, if you're not following along. While some of you may use OU6.2 as the transport, to tell you the truth, we see very few problems reported in that area, so either not very many people are using it or it's solid as a rock, which is a good thing, I suppose. But just to give you a high-level overview of what the TCP/IP layering looks like, this picture here kind of gives you an idea. So if you look at the application in this case as being the channel initiator address space, and the flow of information to and from it comes through the TCP layers. So at the bottom, starting at the bottom, you have the network interface, which talks to the actual physical device that is on the network. If you're running ZOS, that's probably an OSA card of some sort. And then you have the IP layer, which is a transport for a header at the layer below the TCP layer. Then you have two ways of getting to applications. There's TCP using that protocol, or UDP, which is another protocol that Webster MQ does not use. So we're just looking at the left-hand leg here, which is the TCP portion of that. So if something happens below the channel initiator address space, whether it's in the TCP layer, the IP layer, the network interface layer, or the physical network, you can see where that could cause a problem here. Now, as far as the UDP is concerned, that only comes into play when the channel initiator is making calls to resolve a connection name to an IP address to be able to connect or to resolve a client coming in. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. Let's go to slide 26, please. This is a very busy slide. And you might want to take this out and post it on your wall or keep it someplace on your desktop, on your computer or whatever. But it's a good place to reference about how TCP/IP works. And if you look at the very top of the page, you have the client and server. If you think of those as either channel initiator address spaces or a client on the network connecting to a channel initiator on the right-hand side being the server, it kind of shows you how the network flows when a connection is created, all the way through transferring data and then closing that connection. So if you start at the very top, I'm going to run through this really quick. A client does a connect. This client and server model is actually TCP/IP, I should say that, as opposed to a WebSphere MQ model. So client and server in this case means a TCP/IP application, client and server. So the one doing the connect is always considered the client from a TCP/IP perspective. So that causes a SYN, an ACK-SYN, and an ACK, which is called the three-way handshake in the TCP world, to create a TCP/IP connection. And once that flow happens, both connection states are established. And at that point, the application can actually start exchanging data. Up until that point, the applications have very little to do with it other than requesting a connection for another side. And that only works, of course, if you look at the right-hand side of this diagram, that if there is a listen open for the port on the other side where the client is trying to connect. In this case, it would be the channel initiator or a channel listening for on a particular port. Once the connection is established, then you can exchange data back and forth across the connection. That's what the middle arrows and diagram shows you, 100 bytes being sent both directions, the acknowledgement for both those. And then on the left-hand side, you'll see a client requesting a close of the connection. Well, when that happens, the offend bit is sent across the network to notify the other side that we're closing the connection. And at that point, they're waiting for the other application on the other side to issue a close. And that's what Kenneth was talking about a little bit ago, that sometimes things can happen in the TCP/IP world where one side will try to close a connection, and the other side doesn't close the connection, and you may end up with a connection in the closed wait state. That's saying that the other application doesn't know or doesn't want to close the connection yet. Anyway, so then once those fins are flowed and the acts are flowed from both sides, the connections go into a closed state. So anyway, it gives you a real high, quick overview of how the TCP/IP network works, and of course the way channels use the TCP/IP network. So let's go to slide 27. And we'll talk about some of the common problems we see and what they mean from a channel perspective. There's domain name server issues, and what happens is anytime a client comes into the channel initiator requesting a connection, the channel initiator will actually do a reverse name lookup for that IP address to get the host name associated with that IP address. And that's all well and good, and when everything's working fine, that's great. But sometimes you can get channels hung in a substate of name server because the name server that we're using to resolve that IP address is not responding. And delays in those DNS responses can cause these CSQX014E messages. And keep in mind that this task within the channel initiator is single-threaded. So if you have a bunch of clients coming at one time or, you know, very close together, and the DNS response is delayed, you have all these channels backing up because this is single-threaded through this one task. So, again, this is probably a domain name server problem, and you need to check the resolver settings in the TCP/IP configurator or the resolver.config file on ZOS. And what you need to look at is how many name servers are being used and are they responsive. And the resolver timeout value for the resolver on ZOS, the default is 30 seconds, and that's really a long time. So, you know, you might want to look at putting that down to a much smaller value. And I think in ZOS 1.8, that you can actually put that at sub-second response time, something to consider. And then there's a bypass for these get name info lookups for client IP addresses that connect. We put out a PTF in version 6 and version 7 that allows you to tell the channel initiator, don't look up client IP addresses to get the host names. And there's the two APARs and PTFs. But it does require a service parameter, and you'll need to come to us to get that service parameter. Let's go to slide 28, please. Now, recently we've seen some other problems that have caused what appears to be name server hangups when it's really not a name server problem. And what the cause of that happened to be was that there were many clients connecting at one time and closing, or short-lived client connections, and it was generating multiple CSQX 500i and 501i messages, which means the client connection is opening, a client connection is closing. There was another vendor application that was intercepting those WTO messages and was delaying the processing of those messages. So we've kind of created a couple of tech notes that you can refer to from our service portal there. You can search for the two tech note numbers, 127-2913 or 1585-797. Those will help you diagnose those problems where channels seem to be hung in a substate name server condition. And then there's also you can suppress the CSQX 500 and 501i messages, but that also requires a service parameter, which, again, you'll need to come to us to get. Let's go to slide 29, please. Now, we talked about, or Beverly mentioned these just a few minutes ago, about the CSQX 208EZ and 206EZ, the 20-something EZ messages reflecting a transport error. In this case, the 208EZ message says that there is an error receiving data. means that the chin was expecting data from the other side, and it didn't happen. And then the 206 easy message is very similar, except the channel was in the process of sending data, and there was an error. And the error is represented by the TCP return code and reason codes displayed in the messages. The first one, of course, says that there is a reset on the connection. And then the second one says that there, when you tried to send the data, the TCP was not found. That's a TCP IP reason code. And that TCP there means that that's a transmission control block, which is a TCP IP control block representing that connection. And that also probably points to a reset somewhere on the connection between the two channels, or the client and the server con. So let's go to the next slide, and we'll try to give you a picture of what that means. So if we have a client somewhere in the network, and it's connecting through an IP cloud to the ZOSQ manager or the channel initiator, we have these CSQX 208 or 206 easy messages show up in the channel initiator test space. So the problem shows up here, but the problem could have been anywhere. It could have been up in the client, or the connection from the client to the IP cloud. It could have been anywhere in the IP cloud, or it could have been on the local network where the ZOSQ manager lives. The only thing that we know for sure is that the problem was reported on the ZOSQ manager. So, you know, sometimes you may own the IP cloud and the client. Sometimes you may not be able to control what goes on in the IP cloud because you're using someone else's network. Or you may not own the client because it's either a customer of yours or another vendor that's working with you. And so you can't always have control over the whole TCP/IP network. So let's go to slide 31, please. So what do we know? We know the problem is reported on ZOS. The reset is not generated from the reporting host, meaning ZOS is not doing the reset. We're just reporting it. And it could come from the other host, or it could come from any intermediate firewall somewhere in the IP cloud. So how do we diagnose this? Sometimes you can only trace one point, and you can tell a lot from what you trace on the say you own the ZOS host. You can trace there. You can get a channel trace, a network trace on the local network there. And you can determine about what happens from a TCP/IP trace, a network trace. However, you might not be able to point to what the cause of the root cause, because it may be somewhere outside of ZOS. So you may need to trace not only from the client, but also from intermediate hops along the way to be able to narrow down the root cause of the problem. And like I said, sometimes that you may have control over that, and sometimes you may rely on your customers or other vendors to get those traces for you. And sometimes, it's not easy to coordinate all that. So slide 33 is just another picture, a clean picture of the overview of the TCP/IP network. And we know a lot of stuff goes on in that picture of an IP cloud we see there. And that can mean many vendors, many customers, and many your routers and firewalls within that cloud. Let's go to slide 34. And that's just a brief overview of the transport layer and the complications that we deal with when we talk about channels, whether it's ZOS or in the distributed world, and how to diagnose problems in the transport area. And just to give you a brief overview of what that means. So, again, some of the links that may be helpful for you. The MQ support portal is that first link. And then there's some must-gather documents for channels in general, and then for shared channels and trigger channels. Those are web links to must-gather documents if you need to open up a problem for us to look at. Some of the data that we'd like to see when you open a problem up can be found in those must-gather documents. I'm going to turn this back over to Joseph on page 34.
Thank you, Beverly, Kenneth, Rick, and Mark for a great presentation. At this point in time, Jackie, we would like to open the line for questions.
We have no questions on the phone. We do have one question that populated on the phone. From Tom Morris, your line is open.
Yeah, hi. It's never been clear to me what in what situations a requester and the server channels could be used. I mean, why would you use those types of channels? Most implementations I've had experience with are sender-receiver and cluster sender-receiver and client channels, but I haven't found, and I don't know how to use these requester and server channels in what context.
Yeah, and this is Mark here. So I guess the best way to think about it is, you know, as you say, you use the types of channel that you need for your particular application infrastructure. So in the typical scenario where you're just using point-to-point sender-receiver, anytime you want to set up connectivity between QManager A and QManager B for those types of channels, you've always got to start your work from the sender side. You don't have a choice in the matter. But if you know that you've got a requester-side-based application that is going to at times request information from the remote side, then it would make sense that you can use a server requester configuration so that the requester can contact the server when he's ready to get information from that remote side. So it really kind of boils down to what kind of application requirements do I have? Is it a case where I know that I'm only going to need the sender to always start the connection, or do I have a case where a requester side based application makes more sense because I know my requests are going to come from that remote end? And kind of like I was saying before, the requester-server scenario allows for callback as well, so you can initiate the connection that way. So it gives you just more alternatives based on where your applications run from, what kind of channel topology makes sense.
Yeah, can you say, do you have any examples that would explain that scenario?
Sure. Any kind of app. We don't see a lot of server requester scenarios in use. But if you've got an app from side B that runs and you don't want side A to try to start the connection, then you will put it on side B. Yeah, I think Kenny may have an example.
Okay. I guess the best example I've seen is you got company A and company B. Company B is the receiving side or the requester side. Since it's a totally different company, you don't have authority to start the sender channel. But there are times where you may want to initiate the data flowing to you. So you set up the server requester pair. And the receiving side or the inbound side can say, I'm ready to receive data from your outbound channel. So that's the scenario that seems to make the most sense to me.
Yeah, and it may, it may be even point of sale or terminal situation. I go to a travel agent and I say, hey, I want to reserve a flight for, Tahiti. And I'm at their office. They have a requester set up, so they initiate the connection to the remote side. And so it's sort of a need-based request in that case.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
We'll do another question on the phone from Hal Kaplan. Your line is open.
Could you explain exactly what authorizations are required on a receiver or requester channel when using a non-administrative MCA user, particularly when the sender side resets the sequence number, and how are scratch files used?
Yeah. Can you clarify? I'm not even familiar with what scratch files are, or if someone else on the group chat has an idea.
Well, apparently they maintain sequence numbers. It's not very well documented. Basically, the situation is I have a receiver or a requester channel that uses an MCA user, and the MCA user is not MQM. It's not administrative account, and I need to know what authorizations at the OAM level are required when the corresponding sender channel resets the sequence number.
Okay, and it sounds like you're talking distributed, and our presentation is mainly in the scope of Z connections.
Right, and I believe the question is the authority that you need to use in order to get the request on your channel.
Yes.
That security from a security aspect.
Yes, and there seems to be some enabling required to do this. Is it documented anywhere? Are there details?
Oh, is the way security is set up on the platform in question, on the ZOS platform, it is set up by your security administrator, depending on your security management manager that you're using, whether it's the IBM is RECF or ACF, you can define a default user that will be given authority for that channel so you can make your request. Now, from the distributed point of view, that's something else.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
We have no further questions over the phone.
Thank you, Jackie. Now, I see two questions here, actually one in a group chat, so I'm going to announce the question verbally over the telephone. The question is, how can we ensure that a channel will be able to automatically reconnect to a remote queue manager even after a long period of unavailability of such remote queue manager? And by long, I'm referring to a couple of hours.
Okay, so, you know, just kind of in a general way, I mean, connectivity kind of boils down a lot to whether MQ even knows that the connection went down. So we have a couple timers in place, and the timers that actually work depend on the connectivity that still exists. If we've got a total network break between the two endpoints, then timers such as a keep alive interval come in handy, because then the two stacks on each end can try to communicate to each other. And the default to send keep alive timer is 2 hours, but the user can define at the channel level a much smaller interval, or they can code the keep alive interval as auto, which means it'll be whatever the heartbeat interval is plus 60 seconds, so about 360 seconds, and then keep alive probes will flow. The TCP stack will flow 12 probes, will flow probes spaced, I think, about 12.75 minutes. At which point, if it doesn't get a response to the keep alive probe, then it'll totally say the connection is gone and give an indication to MQ. MQ does have short timers and long timers when a channel is in retry state to tell us how long we'll wait and how many times we'll try in order to reestablish connectivity. So those timers are in place, but those can be manipulated by the user to set those timers shorter or longer depending on how they think their network typically works, how available the network is, and how long they expect the outage, you know, may be. And then, of course, there's the MQ heartbeat timer and our disconnect interval timer for cases where the transmit queue has been empty and we want to go ahead and disconnect the connection. So the user playing with our set of timers that are available in MQ and playing with the keep alive infrastructure helps to help reestablish connectivity.
We have a question from Kelly Agnelkalos. Your line is open.
I have an answer for the gentleman earlier who was asking about the MCA user and sequence numbers. We ran into this problem earlier on when we were upgrading to MQ7. And what needs to happen is he needs to give the MCA user authentication or authorization to system channel sync queue.
Yes, and to add to that, yes, that's one of the uses of the sync queue, to keep track of synchronization.
So that MCA user needs to have authentication to that queue. And it's a plus put.
Thank you.
We have no more questions over the phone.
And we don't have any other questions in the group chat either. So at this point in time, we will conclude the presentation.